Hey, it's Chuck BB from Black Metal and Nemesis Covers. You're listening to 15 Minutes with Mark Wade.
Hey, this is 15 Minutes with Mark Wade. We have me, Ian Brill, the editor of a whole bunch of comics.
And Daphna, the editorial assistant to a whole bunch of comics.
Hi, and I'm Mark Wade, who writes a whole bunch of comics and is the editor-in-chief. And what are we talking about today? You asked a question just before we cranked up the Victrola here about... Ian was asking before, like, the difference between doing a full script as a writer and doing plot first, giving it to the penciler, and then getting it back to do dialogue on. And it's... I mean, both styles are...
The Stan Lee style, as the latter is known.
All right, so I actually prefer doing full script, which is all the scene directions, all the dialogue, everything all at once, because it's harder, because you have to focus on every step of the process all at once. It's the difference between filming a commercial and then going back and doing editing later and doing looping and so forth, or shooting something that you know is going to be, you know, in the can just as it is. You don't get a chance to go back and fix and tweak. It's a terrible analogy. You will edit that out. It's just, you have to concentrate on everything at once. The upside of that is then you can really polish it to a diamond-like clarity, and you can go in and you can really shine it up. The downside to it is it takes longer. For some reason, and no one understands the math on this, a plot can take me like a day to do, and dialogue can take me like a day to do, but a full script will take me like 4 days to do.
Well, you're thinking more about shots. You're thinking more about, well, is that what we were talking about with the first issue? That weird chemistry of which 8 pages is this?
Yeah.
How long should I spend on this? Should it be 5 pages? Should it be 6 pages?
Yeah, but I still do that.
That's the artist problem.
But not so much. When I do it, it's different for everybody. But when I do it, I still, like, I know, like, I mean, Bendis is different. Bendis does full script, but Bendis does, what he'll do is he'll do like 5 pages worth of dialogue.
Yeah.
With,
he'll break it apart.
And he'll leave the artist to, he'll basically just say, okay, this scene takes place in Avengers Mansion. Mm-hmm. And here's 5 pages of dialogue. Mm-hmm. And then it'll be up to the artist to break it up.
Why am I not surprised?
Keith
DeCanda does that too.
It's a very specialized skill, and he seems to make it work. So, with me, what I try to do is I write it much like a script, like a paragraph per beat or a paragraph per panel, and I still do the page breakdowns, although I make it clear to the artist that he's got a little more flexibility and fluidity in moving stuff around if he wants to. And I rough in dialogue, but the Mark Wade of 4 weeks ago is who did the plot is always selling out the Mark Wade of today. Because the Mark Wade of today is always looking at the plot going, and then J. Jonah Jameson says something funny. And I'm like, oh my God, now it's due. It's due now.
It's Calvin and Hobbes and his homework.
Yeah, and it's due now. And that's the other thing about doing plot dialogue is that, you know, when the pages come in from the artist and you've got to put down dialogue, you would better be on that day, buddy. There's no slacking. I dialogued like an entire issue of Spider-Man last weekend because it went to two different artists. There was a deadline crunch, and it all had to be done all at once. And I was in a crappy mood on Sunday. There was no excuse for it. I was not funny. I was not clever. I was not witty. And I had to rise to the challenge and write funny stuff, and it was really hard.
But here's the thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes Spider-Man's not always funny.
Oh.
Sometimes you can use that into the script. Spider-Man doesn't want to be funny.
Except the parts where I've already...
Every single dialogue balloon has dot, dot, dot.
I know. except for the parts where the artist has already drawn a thing where he's clearly saying something funny to somebody. So it's...
They might be laughing at his pain. Peter Parker has it hard.
It does. He does. He had to walk in on his... Aunt May. It was
so many balloons say, "Stop laughing at me."
I know. What's so funny, huh? Yeah.
Why are you crying?
I know. I mean, the upside of that is...
Why are you eating a giant invisible sandwich?
I know. The upside of that is that it also gives you the chance to work with an artist. And a lot of times, you know, the artist will pull off stuff in the visuals that you didn't think could be pulled off. Or he's conveying more in the art than... you're prepared for, which is great, so you don't have to put in that. There's a lot of times where in my plots I plan to put a lot of dialogue to explain this and this and this, and you get the page back and you'll go, well, this is you know, it's the old saw about how a picture's worth 1,000 words. You don't really need anything here.
Mm-hmm.
It makes my job much easier. But it still goes slowly. It's still a long process. And I say this with no specific axes to grind, but there are times when I've gotten pages back from younger artists who maybe are not as keyed into how storytelling is done, and you're looking at the page and going, "Oh, sweet Jesus! There's no, I have to put down nothing but dialogue to explain what just happened here."
That's
a lot of
something another editor, not me, has dealt with.
Yeah, you have to spackle the dialogue over the gaps in storytelling. It's either way works. I mean,
I'm opening a door.
God, there was, I did one story, I won't name the comic because it will then lead to the name of the creator who's still working today. He's a nice guy, but I did a
it's
comic.
It's a guy.
That narrows it down.
I did plot dialogue, and not only was his storytelling just from hunger, and it was world class awful, and you couldn't tell, and I had to put in a bunch of dialogue, but I got 13 pages in a row not only without backgrounds, but without ground planes of any sort whatsoever.
They're just floating.
They're just punching each other, and they're just whacking around with each other, and he would draw a lot of little teeny tiny panels instead of big panels, which meant that every panel had a room for a balloon that said, like, what? And that's it. That's all you'd have room for.
That's how the silent issues were born.
Oh my God! It was the worst experience of my creative life. It was just looking at this, going, "I don't know. I don't. They're not. There's not even a ground plane. I don't even know where they are. I have to keep explaining where they are." Now, you almost knocked me out of the Empire State Building. That was tough. Full script is better because you have more control, and not over the artist or anything, but I just mean more control over the story. You feel like you're more in touch with all the pieces of it, but boy, it's a lot more labor intensive, as Paul Morrissey will tell you, waiting for Incredibles pages from me. So
do you go
and our script? Next guest on the show, Mr. Paul Morrissey.
Exactly. You were gonna ask.
I was gonna ask do you tend to go full script if you don't know who your artist is?
Yeah, because that way you're just artist proofing it that way, because you don't. I mean, and a lot of times it works out great, but better to get in there. The other thing you do is, if you're smart, you always make sure that you say in the first paragraph of your script,
mm-hmm.
"Dear artist, here's my phone number, here's my email.
Yeah.
Please, if you got any questions, I look forward to working with you," which may or may not be the truth, but it sounds good. And
you have just terrified half the artists you work with.
Yes. And I'm like,
please add in, "Don't do this behind the editor's back." Let me just add that part. That if the artist does contact the writer, and I believe every writer should do what Mark just said, keep the editor in the loop.
Loop, exactly. So, but it's important that the creative people talk to each other. It's, again, collaborative medium. So,
I totally believe that. I mean, there are a lot of times where I am
playing air traffic controller with creative people.
I remember that word. And it is better when people are talking.
Yeah. No, it's always better when people are communicating with each other. That's the thing. It's possible to do seamless work otherwise.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, I don't think that's a revelation to anybody who's listening to the podcast. I'm sorry, I just wasted 10 minutes of your time. But that's kind of where we are with that. So
we have 5 more minutes to kill, guys.
Are you kidding me?
Well, I do. Well, that's okay.
You have
I do have
editing motions. They're not going anywhere.
I do have. I do have another question.
Please. Okay. Yes.
Which do you think artists prefer? Because I know. I read something where Gil Kane said he preferred the Stan Lee method.
Yeah.
Do you think? You know, I would assume, but although in this job I've learned to assume nothing, I would assume that artists would like the plot breakdown,
you know,
so they have control
over
it.
You would think so, and as a general rule, I think most of them do, and there are times when it really works. I mean, Michael Ringo and I, when we worked together on Fantastic Four, I did full script for like the first year and a half, and then we talked about what he was looking for. I mean, we talked all the time, we were best friends, but still, we were talking specifically about the work, and he said, "Well, I want to try this." He said, "I'm not really used to working with you on a plot dialogue breakdown."
Yeah.
And so that worked out well. But before then, he was perfectly capable. He was perfectly comfortable with doing full script. More to the point, when I was working at CrossGen, insert scream.
We should have a sound effect. We should have the Price is Right when they lose.
What's the name of the scream?
The Wilhelm scream
every time somebody mentions the word CrossGen. There was an artist I worked with there, great guy, amazing guy, and I assumed he would want, more of a breakdown. And I sat down with him, and he's like, no, actually, I prefer a full script. I just like to, it doesn't mean we can't talk about it and make adjustments, but he wanted the clearest sense possible of what I was looking for in the story. So, okay.
I've definitely seen that in artists, too, and that took me by surprise in a good way, I'd say, where there are artists who are like, hey, let's work together, not someone who says, I have to own this story now.
I will say this from what I've learned over the years about not only full scripting but also plotting, which is that, and this is different from artist to artist, but as a general rule, what I found talking to the Q-Birds and Ringo and Barry Kitson and a lot of the other guys I've worked with is that 5 is this magic number in terms of panels on a page.
Yes.
They find that a lot of artists find that 5 panels gives them the most amount of flexibility in terms of how they can break down the page, how they can lay out the panels.
Yeah.
4 is one thing, 6 is 6 gives you kind of a grid if you can't, if you're
once,
you're
not once you get to even numbers, I guess 9 is also a grid. Yeah. Multiples of 3, I guess.
Exactly, whatever. Okay, yeah. Once you get into anything that looks like a grid, it's very seductive for the artist to just sit down and just draw the grid. Whereas 5 sort of challenges him to think about panel placement and panel size and so forth. And it gives them also a chance to do like the one big money shot on a page and then 4 other smaller panels. So
that being said, future comic book writers of America and beyond, don't think, oh, I got to panel 5, let's start a new page. That's I've seen that as well. Don't do that.
That's not
what Mark was talking about.
No, it's not a hard and fast rule. That's just a good rule of thumb to go by, which is roughly 5 panels a page. Don't do anything stupid in them, like have a coliseum in one panel and a baseball stadium in another. It's just, don't have a
there goes my new doctor.
There goes your
coliseum.
Coliseum.
Had so much potential.
Full of stampeding horses comic that you were going to do. So,
well, they're stampeding. They got to get to a baseball game.
That's true. Hey, look, are we almost out of time?
You guys are seriously trying to run the clock.
We are.
The cutest thing.
All right.
Running over like words.
Mark. Munsters or Adam's Family?
Adam's Family, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I just, first off.
I'm not against Adam's Family.
No, I'm not saying. I'm against him. No, it's not that. It's just Munsters. When I was a kid, Munsters.
Oh, yeah.
But getting older, Adam's Family, just a little more sophisticated and creepy.
Yeah.
More sexual tension.
Definitely. I think they were like the first couple to share a bed or something like that.
They were one of the early couples to
and more Lovecraftian.
And just a wider variety.
This one's easy for me. I Dream of Jeannie or Bewitched.
That one's tougher.
Really?
I knew this was going to happen.
I was tougher because when I was a kid, Elizabeth Montgomery was my very first crush, my very first celebrity crush.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, I Dream of Jeannie. You?
Is it because she's so subservient?
Yes, that's why.
I'm just saying. Bewitched had a
first of all, she's not very subservient. She keeps screwing things up. She's not a great servant. She does call him master, but she's not like effective at what she does.
No, she's actually very she's not very good at that part. So,
but it's Bewitched all the way. I mean, that is, I enjoyed it when I was younger, just as a I like shows about with magic and stuff, which we don't have anymore. Alas, we don't have talking horses or anything like that. But now
you
watch it.
Witches of Waverly Place on Disney.
I'm afraid not, but I will start now. And that Bewitched, I think, was probably trying to be one of the most subversive shows on TV in terms of feminism and adding that kind of criticism of the '60s, like early '60s world and gender roles and all that stuff to see what they're doing.
No, she was definitely. I mean, there was a pattern in '50s and '60s television, and it grew out of radio that sort of solidified the sitcom formula as the idiot husband and the genius wife.
Yeah,
and they really took that to the next level of not only that but also powerful, pants wearing wife. And
that's right. She always, well, I guess Mary Tyler Moore was the
Was the breakout, because that was the first one where you didn't have, well, actually not the first one, Julia from with Diane Carroll. This is boy.
Oh yeah,
can't believe we're talking about this. But
could be the next podcast.
Comics fans love Diane Carroll. It's a fact. You can look it up. It's on Wikipedia. And
did you edit it yourself?
She had her own series for a while. That was actually Mike W. Barr's first thing. Was the Diane Carroll comics for Marvel. That was one of the things they licensed in, what was that, 1971?
Yeah, that sounds right. Okay.
Yeah, none of that was true.
No. No, all a lie. All right, I think we're going to wrap up now before we start talking about Fibber McGee and Molly again. I'm Mark Wade.
I'm Daphna.
And I'm Darren Stevens.
There you go. All right. Over and out.